first meeting.
Great. And I'll just start out by saying this is Grace Tatter interviewing Mr. Stuart Wells on September 29th, 2013 in his home. And we're going to be talking about Lambda and UNC in the late 1970s. But first off, I was wondering if you could just tell me about your childhood and kind of your life pre-UNC. Just a quick summary.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, I was born and grew up in eastern North Carolina, about halfway between the Triangle and the coast in Greenville, and had a very conventional childhood in a lot of ways. I had two older brothers, and they were a great influence, particularly in terms of making learning fun. And I had a brother that would give me tests, and we would play school even, you know, in our free time. And so I was a Cub Scout and I was even a Weeblo Scout. And then when we started doing rope knots, I think I lost interest at that point. Also, I think it was also at that point when I was becoming more conscious of the fact that I was not quite the typical, heterosexual boy, and my interest started to change. But my interest had been ignited really since about the sixth grade in journalism. I worked on an elementary school newspaper. I think someone, maybe at that point it was a guidance counselor, saw something different in me and maybe saw that I was a little bit of an outsider, which makes the perfect journalist, someone who doesn't fit in every kind of way. Although, I mean, I could easily fit in and pass as straight, and so had to fend off lots of questions from relatives about who I was dating and that kind of thing. But really, by the time I was in junior high, I started to pretty much just do my own thing. Two older brothers, I think, met the conventional expectations of my parents. And so there was a little less pressure on me. But I was asked out by a friend, a girl who asked me out to the prom, and I didn't want to lead her astray, and so I didn't go. I could have gone along, and I just threw myself into working on the school newspaper. I thought, well, this is something I like to do, and I can see myself working for a newspaper, or working for a radio station or something, doing news. And so even in high school, I worked a lot in my free time on the paper. My friends were often other staff members on the paper. And then I did a radio show for the high school on that ran on Saturday, I think. But I would go after school, like maybe on Thursday afternoon, and they would tape it for the local radio station. So when I came to UNC, I was they needed someone to volunteer to work on Lambda, and so I was willing to volunteer because it's the kind of thing I had done. I did feel a little funny working for something that was more an activist-oriented newsletter. And so my participation, I mean, I would type it up and put it together, but my participation was to write more conventional kinds of articles for the most part that were just like I would work on stories at the journalism school and just put in the essential information and have both sides, and if there were two sides, there probably wasn't time to get two sides, or I would have done it more often. But and somehow we put it together. I don't even remember how often it came out. I think about every month, but because we put the month name on it, but it might not have been quite every month.
And So did you say you got involved in your freshman year, or was it later in your college career that you found out about Lambda?
Well, I knew about the group, and I went to meetings and things, but I really did. I must not have volunteered until my junior year.
Did you also write for the Daily Tar Heel or anything before that?
No. I had a work-study job, so I was working at UNC-TV, I think from my freshman year, because that's the only work-study job I remember. And their offices at the time were in University Square, up above a florist, at least, I think even then. Yeah, I think there was a florist. Later there was, I know there was a florist on the bottom level. Anyway, it was like a three-story, four-story building. And the studio was in Swain Hall, but the offices and some of the production was in University Square, too. But I helped with publicity, helped with the woman who did the Centerpiece magazine, and they let me write a few news releases and things. So... that was a good. It was a good job because it did give me some good experience. But I didn't have time to work for the Daily Tar Heel. I would have liked to.
It's a big commitment, though.
Yeah, a big commitment. This was like a little less of a commitment because basically I was doing this probably one long weekend of time, chunks of time before each issue, and I would go over to Howell Hall and find a free typewriter. Back in the days when everything was, I guess it's still open to students, but back then it was just, you know, everything was open. And you just go into one of the labs and I'd find a typewriter. And I didn't even type at that point. I had taken typing in high school, but then I really hadn't stuck. And so I was, you know, hunting and pecking. So it's a wonder that I was able to get something out as often as we did, and we had help. I mean, most of the help though that I remember. I mean, I remember doing most of the typing, and then we'd have help stuffing envelopes and getting it mailed out.
What was UNC like when you arrived there? I know that, you know, I guess girls, it was just becoming a thing for girls to be there for all 4 years, maybe at the beginning of the 70s, so before you got there, and then I know that it's a little bit after all of the excitements in the 60s with the civil rights activism and the Vietnam War, so you're after all of that, but was there still this spirit of kind of activism on campus, or was it a progressive place? What was it like?
Mm-hmm. I think it was. I think it was still, there was just, people had a lot of, it was just expected that you would get involved, you would take a stand. The Black Student Organization was active. A lot of people were engaged in one or the other organization, a variety of organizations. And I felt, I mean, I think the Carolina Gay Association got support from various professors. I don't remember that interaction as much because I was involved more from the standpoint of just helping with publicity, and I didn't really organize, work on organizing the conferences, for example, which were the big activity. but when I arrived in the fall of 75, I mean, there was definitely, you know, there was beer kegs at the dorm, or maybe that was the second year. Maybe that was the welcoming at Alexander dorm. I think it was the second, my sophomore year. But my first year was at Morrison dorm, and there was, you know, I can't remember. I mean, I think it just seemed like women had already always been there.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was at Alexander, my roommate, who I really didn't know, he and his girlfriend spent a lot of time in our dorm room, and various times, and I had to sort of like be, you know, when do you need it? When do you need privacy? It was my first year there, I mean, I felt like I was just, it was where I really should be. I had been on campus for a Scholastic Press Association activity in the summer, and just felt, you know, oh, this is, you know, the place for me. And of course, it was at a distance from my parents, and so I could be myself. And the very one, like within of just a few weeks of arriving, there was a party because the Carolina Gay Association had just formed, maybe the year before, I guess.
Yeah,
and they had a dance or a party in the basement of Craig Dorm, which was right across from Morrison, so it was even convenient, you know, to get to things.
How did you find out about the dance? Was there flyers, or was it in the DTH, or word of mouth?
I think it was probably in the DTH. But it may have also been a flyer, because it may have been that I just immediately made contact as soon as I got there, and somewhere in the student union found something or saw something posted. Yeah.
Was it at all nerve-wracking, kind of, to all of a sudden, you know, go to a Carolina Gay Association thing where it's like, oh,
yeah,
gay is in the title, it's all out there.
Yeah, it could just be, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I know, I think I remember it just, and I was going by myself because my roommate was a conservative kind of guy from, I don't know how conservative, but I mean conservative compared to me. From Black Mountain, and you know, his neighbor was Billy Graham, and so it was a matter of just going over. Probably, I don't know. I don't remember a lot of hesitation. I remember, you know, wanting to go, and so I went. But it had to be, you know, it had to be without really sharing where I was going, and I remember it being stressful. I mean, my freshman year. It all is wrapped up in telling my parents that I was gay, and I sent them a letter, and then my mother calling and wanting to talk to me and was concerned about me, and I don't know, calling classes even and trying to get in touch with me during the day, which is almost impossible, you know. And finally talking to her, I was back in the dorm room at some point in the afternoon, I guess, and talking to them. I'd already told my brother, my oldest brother, so all of this was happening at the same time. I'm taking a full load, and the classes are really, some of them are a struggle, and so I did not, I had to pull out of that first semester. I had sort of a nervous breakdown, and that was late in the year, probably November. But it meant not getting credit for some of the classes. Some I did, but I had to take summer school classes to make up for it. Maybe one summer? One or two summer? I think it was one summer, and just took a lot of classes and made up for what I lost. And then, you know, and then I gradually made my way back into it, So that was a stumble. That's one reason why you wouldn't see me working on Lambda, probably, I'm sure, until maybe I got involved a little bit my sophomore year. I can't remember. But I wouldn't have been able to take on anything else at that point. Yeah.
Was the Carolina Gay Association a good support network once you got back?
Yeah, once I really, and again, I joined a consciousness raising group, and that's written about in this this other piece that Peter did, and that the consciousness raising group was so helpful because it met maybe weekly, even.
I think so. That's what I.
It met often, and at the beginning of the week, at the Lutheran Student Center, and which I remember as just being upstairs in an old house, which may have been where one of the staff lived or something as well, you know. But that was, I think, critical to feeling good about myself. And that was probably my sophomore year at some point, or at least the first half of my time at UNC. And that was really made a tremendous difference and made me feel confident enough to want to step out and write for this newsletter and, you know, take my chances. I mean, at that point, maybe I thought I would be getting a job outside of North Carolina. I don't know, but the jobs were all in small towns, and it didn't catch up with me really until maybe 4 years after I had started working. And someone in Spring Hope who knew me and I think was sort of interested in dating me, even though I was trying my best not to make promises in that direction. But someone in her church knew that I was involved with the Carolina Gay Association, had heard, remembered it or read about it. Must have known about it, because it was nothing. I wouldn't have been in print later. I was ready to leave anyway. I can't remember. That might have had something to do with me, though, moving it along and going ahead and trying to find work somewhere else. Just because it's such a small town. People may have just suspected that I was gay from talking to me at other times, but there was nothing that, later it really didn't come up after that. I was in Yanceyville, I was in Fuquay Varina.
All very small towns.
And I guess maybe people, you know, if they ever knew or had remembered that I was involved in Lambda, it faded and no one brought it up or used it against me later. And I don't think actually they could have used it against me, because by that point gay people were appearing on the Phil Donahue show, and you know, and it was pretty much we were already farther along at that point. I mean, I'm surprised sometimes we were pretty far along in the 70s. In a way, there was support from churches even back then. Of course, it was Chapel Hill, so Chapel Hill's always been about 10 years ahead. So,
although people still, it looked like you didn't use your name in a Lambda until April 1978, I think, and then there was still a lot of pseudonyms. It took me a while. When I was reading them, I kept seeing P. Mantis. I was like, that's an interesting last name. And then, like, finally I was like, oh, that's not a name.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me, too, because I hadn't remembered how few people use their name, but it's true. The graduate students felt a certain amount of safety. And so the people that organized the conference... Well, everybody was in the conference brochure, but that's not as, you know, widely distributed. Certainly their pictures were on this one. But that's not the same as having a name either. And their names are not listed in here, you know. In fact, really just the conference coordinator. That's the only name.
And was that Dan Leonard?
That was Tom Carr for this one. So there was concern. I mean, and you would leave Chapel Hill. We left Chapel Hill it must have been probably my senior year, and we went down to Wilmington because Anita Bryan was speaking at the auditorium at UNC Wilmington. And several carloads went down. And then there were other people from other parts of the state. And we protested, and it was covered by the paper. I was sort of relieved that I wasn't in a photograph that... you know, went around the state. But we were getting sort of winding down anyway, and then there were some people, local people, who started running after some of us and chasing a group, another group, and we saw what was happening, and everybody else ran and got into their cars and left campus as quickly as possible. And so I can't remember now the details of what, but I think they were chasing us with sticks or something. And we got out of there, and I sort of thought to myself, you know, well, we're not in Chapel Hill for sure, and Wilmington, you know, has always been pretty conservative. So I knew that it was a topic best not broached after I started working and so forth. But during this time, it was sort of like, this is what college is about. It gives you permission. And I guess I really took that to heart. It was like, okay, I can be who I want to be. And maybe I've never really thought through things as well as I should. Maybe I'm a little slow. Or if I thought about it, I might not have used my name. Unfortunately, I didn't get any credit for any of this extracurricular work. I couldn't use it on my resume, even though I had a radio show.
It's a lot to put out.
And edited a newsletter. Yeah. I looked back through these scripts, the radio scripts, and it was like we had sound bites even from the people at the conference. I don't even remember doing how I did that. I guess I had some kind of small tape recorder. That was a lot of fun, and I've always thought that I would enjoy radio too. But print has been a little bit more of a pull. I just wished it had been a better newsletter. There was so much potential, but when you really have only you had people contributing, and then I was just typing it up.
Yeah, that's.
And maybe I would do two columns, but then I realized sometimes I didn't.
And it looked like you also got stuff from other, were you writing everything or would you get stuff from other newsletters like from a wire? Because there was a lot of national.
Yeah, we were pulling things just from other sources. Mm-hmm. There was a lot being written. I mean, there were, but mostly it was gay publications. There was something called Gays Week. There was, I don't know if The Advocate was publishing. It probably was. And we pulled from things like the city gay papers that were existed. And at that point, there weren't that many. But I think there in San Francisco, there was stuff that came. Some of it was at the library, probably. I saw one note that said the undergraduate library was getting copies of Christopher Street, which was kind of more of a New Yorker-style magazine with literary types of articles. But we would get copies of other publications like RFD, which was published in the mountains of North Carolina, and we would just find things that were interesting. Mostly it was, we would give more time, more space to calendar items into things in the triangle, it looks like.
I was surprised, you know, in the 70s in North Carolina, which you think of being as a relatively conservative place, but it seemed like there's a pretty robust gay community, or at least support for the gay community around the triangle just by the number of events listed. It doesn't seem that much fewer than what there is now.
Yeah. Maybe there was more because people were really needed to make connections. Having a conference was as much about feeling support and feeling that you're not alone. There was always references to how important it was for people from rural areas to come and connect with 500, 600 other gay people and know that they weren't the only ones. And the politics almost at times seemed like just a side note.
And it was mostly men, right, who had come to the conferences in the Carolina Gay Association. There wasn't as many women. I noticed in a few names in Lambda that were women, but
yeah, and I think that is I think that's true. I think it was just a handful of women, and judging from this picture too, I mean, I connected with a number of the women, and Karen and Grace, I still see some folks who've stayed in the triangle, but I'm not as connected. I go to the Pride marches, and we went yesterday to the one here in Durham. But my own journalistic sensibilities have been to sort of, as long as I was a working journalist, I wasn't that much of the activist. Even in the conferences, I would attend some of the things, but I felt like I was covering it more than anything else. That's how I just saw myself.
And how did you decide what to cover? I noticed that, I think in the Bobkowski article, they mentioned that there was only one article about discrimination on UNC's campus. Was that just because there wasn't a lot of discrimination going on, or did you purposefully try to cover more of the positive activist things that CGA was doing? Or do you remember mm-hmm. what your mission was, I guess?
I think we would have put it in if there had been any issues, if people had felt threatened. And maybe at that point, the issues had been more about funding for the organization, I think. But we had sort of gone past that hurdle. So I think it was a fairly, smooth sailing from the standpoint of on campus. And I think there was a lot of behind-the-scenes support from administrators and faculty that I probably didn't always hear about. I think maybe more Dan Littern and Tom Carr and others probably felt that. But I did feel it some. I mean, I remember a history professor, telling the class, a big seminar class, that you're at college. This is where you can experiment, or you can explore things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to. And he specifically mentioned, being gay, and so I mean, it was just my sense was, it was my own internal fear that I wouldn't tell journalism professors that I was working on this. Just because I couldn't read them, and then only late in the game was my name here. After my name was on this, they may not have seen it though either, because we mostly distributed it to members, and I don't know that we had the money to print a lot of extra copies. So, and I don't particularly remember just leaving copies around, because it was, I think the focus was more just internal to the organization.
Was it ever difficult for you, or did you think of it as a challenge that you were one of the only publications of your type in the country? I think that I read that Lambda was the first student sexual minority publication was the term. And so was there like the sense of like groundbreakingness, or was it just...
Not in terms of the publication, there wasn't. I really don't think so. In terms of the conference mm-hmm. and the Carolina Gay Association, maybe there was a little bit of that sense that at least in the Southeast we were ahead. I don't think we were connected enough, maybe, to even know nationwide where we stood.
And yeah, it was before the internet where you can Google this and realize you're the only ones.
it was really all by mail. I mean, even long distance phone calls were expensive back then. When you still timed your phone calls, it's like, okay, I've been on too long. Okay, when you called your parents, so it was strictly through the mail. It was, it hadn't advanced much more than colonial times, really. When we did Lambda, it was fortunately. There was a lot of sharing, and we would send Lambda to other groups that were requested it. And we didn't charge them. Prisoners or other organizations, we would just send it to.
And I noticed that there was, I guess it was in the Bobkowski article, it mentioned that there was a lot of communication between prisoners, gay prisoners. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that, because that seemed interesting to me.
Yeah, we would get notes, and I didn't respond directly so much, I don't think. I knew that they were coming through, and that other members, the organizational leadership was responding in different ways. But I wish I knew. I can't remember if they made trips at some time, at some points, or tried to reach out to them beyond writing. I know they wrote and responded. And my interaction with it was just to have seen some of that correspondence, and then I wrote a couple of stories, and I pulled in some things from a field trip in my advanced news writing class, and because I went to Central Prison, and I think we took a couple of trips, and they went to another prison, and you could tell that I was weaving that into some other things that I had pulled from other articles. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a mishmash, but it was all I had time for. I didn't have time for additional interviews or to go, you know, go and do more research. So I sort of am apologetic that now that I read it today.
Well, I was reading through it, and I was pretty impressed. I thought that there was a pretty wide variety. And just even pulling from other sources, you still have to sit down and read the other sources and decide which articles you're going to pick. So it seems like a big time commitment.
Well, you know, and I would go about it like I would any other story. It was to create a little folder and put things aside. And I remember I found some notes here today, things I had put aside saying, you need to follow up on this and this story this story, and I don't know that I ever did or had time to, but I mean, that's what journalists do, is you kind of are watching for things. And someone who was an activist in Raleigh had said that the News Observer, this was dated January 78, and I'd written a note to myself, John Voorhees said in our telephone conversation that the Raleigh Times classified department had rejected a personal classified publicizing a gay Valentine's party. He said he was told that the word gay was probably what violated the newspaper's unspecified standards. So he called the paper's hotline, the reader service, and requested an explanation, which the paper said would be forthcoming. So I have a note to myself, follow up on this. I don't know if I did.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and check.
But and then there was something prison-related that was in the Herald Sun. Well, then it was the Durham Morning Herald, and this was a prisoner who had appealed to prison officials that about being in an all-male prison when he considered himself a woman or herself, and wanted the state to provide the hormone treatments and a sex change operation. So I think we had a lot more ideas for stories. Police departments were still arresting people on morals charges. You know, they would catch them in parks and things and arrest them. And there was there were stories that I think I had I wanted to go ahead and just, you know, become a working journalist even before I left school, and as much as, but whether I don't think I had all that much time to really do that, and I know I always felt like I was struggling to do as much as I did.
And it looked like the staff usually had about 10 people, give or take, the issue. Does that sound about right? Maybe a little fewer?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
And so would you just meet once a month and assign out the stories, and then and you edited all of them,
and then I would throw it together. I don't know if you would call it editing. it was editing, and as I typed,
right,
and then at some point, I know we probably were using like you typed onto a stencil kind of thing, and then later the technology advanced so that they could just take a picture of a typed page and make a mimeograph page that would work on a, you know, the round mimeograph machine. And so at one point we said, we can run pictures now, you know, but I don't know that we had any, maybe one issue, but we never got that many submissions either. That gave me a lot of freedom because I could just fill it up with whatever I wanted to because we had the space most of the time. I mean, the limit probably was just time, you know, here was 10 pages was probably more a factor of how much I could type. And
without computers, I can't really imagine.
No, it was like you had to justify each line, and you had to keep in mind when you were going over the margin. I know when there were mistakes. Well, initially, sometimes we'd just leave them in because it was too hard to change them. And you would see that sometimes. But then later, when it was a matter of taking the photo of it, I'm sure we could use a whiteout. And it made it a little easier, so it started probably looking a little better.
So you mentioned that the conscious raising groups were held at the Lutheran Student Center, mm-hmm. and I know that the first meetings were held at the Newman Student Center, and I know the Chapel of the Cross, and the churches did seem to be fairly involved with the gay student life in Chapel Hill, and I was just wondering how that intersection of religion affected you. Did it make things more comfortable in some ways? Because I'm guessing a lot of people in North Carolina were raised religious, so it was probably...
It was. It was mm-hmm. a comfortable space, and while I was not involved, I didn't get involved in the worship services of any of those congregations, you know, you felt that support in an indirect way, certainly by letting their space be used, and particularly at the Newman Center. I think that was where you felt it the strongest, because we would have a lot of gatherings there, and there were socials and things there that I recall. But I'd never, I may have gone to Binkley once or twice, since my background is Baptist. But really felt disaffected and maybe just missed out because of the logistics. I didn't have a car.
Yeah.
The whole time I was a student, I would go to the bar at Eastgate Shopping Center on the bus, very conscious of when I needed to leave to take the last last Chapel Hill Transit bus, like at 1 a.m. And the guy, oftentimes I would see the guy who worked and took tickets at the movie theater. He would take that same bus back up the hill because he didn't have a car. It was great that it was because it was all there, you know. That was when Chapel Hill had a bar. But then later, you'd have to check. Durham had the main disco. So I came along at a good time. When I needed a car and had to have a car, we found a used Karmann Ghia, and I learned how to drive with a stick shift. And, you know, that's sort of been the story of my life. I just... When I need to do something and I somehow find a way and do it, just like sometimes looking back at some of these things I did, I really can't imagine how I did it, but obviously my love of journalism overcame worries about the repercussions that might be involved. And also just the fact that this was my community. What were the people that were in the consciousness raising group or the people that I knew through CGA? And so that was my support network, and they made me feel comfortable. And maybe we thought, hey, change would be coming faster than it did. I mean, who would, you know, we really thought it was just around the corner, probably. And it's been steady, but it's the nature of change, I guess, that it just takes, it takes finally, I think it really what it really took was more people being open to their families. And then you had almost like the floodgates opened and changes come much more quickly, because that, you know, even former President George H.W. Bush and Barbara knew a gay couple, they've known them for a long time, knew of their commitment over the years. And so, of course, we'll go to your marriage. And, of course, the president will sign the marriage, you know, co-sign the marriage certificate. Because that was, but that was what was sort of missing. And I think it needed the whole of the 80s and probably all of the 90s. The 90s, though, particularly, was when finally people in churches were discussing homosexuality and meeting other gay people and getting to talk to them and know them and get to know their neighbors. And it's sort of like, it's always been, progress has been made, but you just weren't seeing it, but it was just happening through those contacts. And so really I think we're reaping the benefit of that at this point. And now it sort of almost feels like this year, it feels like it's kind of over. It's happened. And the battle, you know, even Republicans now, former President Bush feels like, okay, of course he doesn't have anything to lose at this point. But, I mean, he has a son, though, that might run for president. But I think it's like, okay, I don't know. I don't know. I think there were fears, though, that, I mean, just like with the military, I don't know, there were fears that somehow these are people that are not like us, and it's not going to work out. Have we heard anything, any problems in the military? It's like, oh, gosh, you know, what were people worried about? And it's the same way with the marriage issue, which seems like it should be the conservative point of view. Okay, get married.
Yeah, exactly.
And be committed in a monogamous relationship. So, anyway, that it's been amazing to watch and to watch all the change from small town vantage points to back in Durham, which is of course, you know, has been more open for a long time, but now it's just the rest of it's small towns. Places. And again, it's where people have not, they don't think they've met a gay person. And because of stereotypes, and they have, and, but if you're in a conservative church, the gay people are not going to, you know, really make a big come out and say anything. Or maybe they've already moved. Maybe there are just not as many gay people in small towns. I mean, I made a conscious effort is to move. I was always moving closer to to a metropolitan area, just because you just feel it just feels different, and you don't have to worry about even your safety. I mean, you can go out with a group of friends, and you know, it's just a comfort level.
So when you were at Carolina, the issues that the Carolina Gay Association was talking about wasn't necessarily the right to get married, but just acceptance overall? Or were the political goals already kind of what they are probably at UNC right now, which is marriage equality and things to do with benefits?
It was
more changing the culture.
Yeah, it was more about consciousness raising. For ourselves, too, and because we're coming from backgrounds where, you know, we had our own stereotypes as gay people about who gay people are. And so that, I mean, I did too. You know, and I had to overcome that. But marriage wasn't on the radar at all in the 70s, I don't believe, because, and some gay people felt like, you know, weren't even interested in marriage. That's a more, that was considered to be more traditional. There was still, I guess, some of the 60s free love kind of spin off where We don't need marriage. We're doing a new thing. And but there again, there, it also it, marriage didn't seem like it was conceivably possible. So you know, you go for goals that seem doable first. And the first thing was to avoid discrimination in hiring. And though, and you saw where that was the first thing that we went for in Chapel Hill. There was, and then the council put non-discrimination in place. And then they worked for businesses to do that. And that, it's amazing to me to read back and see how many businesses were doing that in the early 80s. That came pretty early. All that sort of just was there and then sat there. So, and then we sort of just have, you know, and there have been little advances along, but nothing big was happening for maybe 10 years. It was, well, then you had DOMA and you had the military, don't ask, don't tell. And that just sort of put a delay. It was a whole big, you know, delay that sort of worked in a way. It just put the brakes on everything.
You mentioned stereotypes, and I was wondering if you could talk about what the stereotypes were for gay people in the 1970s, because I think that they might be different than they are now. And then also, what, as consciousness raising, how you guys fought those stereotypes and kind of educated people about them.
Yeah, I think the stereotypes for men, they're some of the same. I mean, it was just more the sissy stereotype, and for women, the butch kind of look or manner. But there were also stereotypes about, you know, still gay men were predators, or and the fact that men were getting arrested at rest stops sometimes only fed into that, you know, and that they were. And probably there were stereotypes too, that there were a lot of gay men were pedophiles, that was definitely not the case, not in percentages any higher than, I mean, I think it's, I don't know what it is, but it's probably 10%, which is the same percentage of gays in the population. So. But somehow I think people thought it was a lot higher. It was, you know, among gays. My own, I should just think of what my own stereotypes were. It was men with actually a visible, you know, kind of accent, maybe, that, you know, this was the, they've done a Broadway show about it now, and it showed up some in theater, whatever, the Nance character, who was kind of Nelly, I guess was the word that was used, you know, might even use cosmetics or whatever, definitely would dress in a colorful way. And that probably has been somewhat, I mean, some of that's true. That was the only way you could be identified as being gay. There was, I didn't know it at the time, or I would have tried to pick up on it, but the idea that you would wear a red tie apparently was a signal at one time. And then, of course, red became a popular tie color for politicians later in the 80s. Now it's blue, but you know, in small towns, you know, the stereotype was that the gay guys were the florist and the maybe a librarian or hairdressers, that definitely limited your role models. You know, if that was all you had. And I didn't know that there were many gay journalists. Over the years, I've come to see that there have always been, I don't know whether it's more than 10% of the population, but maybe so, but lots of gay journalists. And only recently have they number have come out and are role models, you know, like Anderson Cooper. So, but I think that's sort of a natural in a way, because if you felt somewhat like an outcast, then being a journalist is something, is a way that you can, something respectable that you can do, but you're always at a distance. You're not, and I wasn't, just like I was saying before, I didn't feel like I was even socially, I didn't connect that well even with the other gay people. I mean, I did to some extent, but I didn't feel like I was up to leading the group. I was just writing about it.
Who were your role models in college? Did you have specific gay role models, or?
I really didn't have gay role models, I don't believe, unless I picked up maybe on people from history or people who were talented, like Oscar Wilde, but he wasn't really a role model. Role models were political activists and not necessarily gay. I think Barbara Jordan was gay, but I didn't know that. But so my role models were straight and gay, and I didn't know whether they were gay, but they were political activists. And Father Mulholland in my hometown, who was a leader in civil rights, and Shirley Chisholm, who ran for president. And I got to go hear, when I was in high school, I got to hear her speak. Maybe role models were strong women, and I often identified with them as they were making strides, and as blacks were making strides. You know, it's like, all right, okay, I know you've got to go first, and you do this, you know, and pave the way. And I've heard this said about Jews who voted for President Obama. It's like, well, if an African American can be president, then, well, one day we'll have a Jewish president. You know, it's like you invest yourself in trailblazers. That was it for me. And I have to go back and look. I mean, there were some gay people who were out and just becoming. I mean, there was a gay football player who came to UNC for one of the conferences, but I wasn't into sports, so he wasn't really a role model. But there was a gay journalist, Perry Dean Young, who I got to talk to, and he was, you know, he was a great journalist. He was a freelance writer at that point. But he was certainly a role model. I'd have to go back and check in the 70s and see who was out at that point. And because I'm sure I latched onto them. And if they were in the media, I mean, gay people, and thank goodness for the mainstream media too, because, I mean, a lot of times gay issues were being written about, I think, because it was titillating. It was, you know, it's related to sex. And so it made a good topic for the talk shows in the 70s. But gay people, we would latch on to that and find solace that things were changing, and that there were people that could be out. You could be interviewed on camera, as opposed to that. There was a documentary in '68 that Mike Wallace did, and the homosexual was interviewed behind a planter, like a artificial tree, and so you know you take any progress that you see. So just having, you know, even though the media was still covering it as as kind of a novelty and something exotic, it was that was okay, because I mean the Carolina Gay Association, that was like, it was got lots of coverage because it was new, and their motive for covering it may have been that this was something exotic in Chapel Hill, which produces crazy stuff, you know. And but that's okay, because what I got out of it listening to it on the news was, oh right, you know, fantastic, these are some of my folks. So other people probably heard something else and said, oh my gosh, oh, we got to nip this in the bud. So the media, that's why, I mean, many of the items that we picked up on were from mainstream media. There was good coverage in the Durham paper of the Carolina Gay Association, at least in in 79 there was, it really impressed me. Again, they didn't have that many people who were willing to use their names, and they sort of picked up on that, and that was a kind of a theme of the story, was here's someone who, a professor from a college in Minnesota. I don't think you better use my name, he added. My parents know, and my employer knows, but I wouldn't want my relatives to find out by reading it in the paper. So that was, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. So when do you think so you said that it took probably until the 1990s when most people, or when it started, just people felt comfortable putting their names and things and talking to their families, and it became more of a just not a big deal.
Right, I think that's about the timeline.
How you mentioned the civil rights movement and just, you know, the women's movement. How did growing up, I guess you're pretty little during the highlights of the civil rights movement, but do you think that rhetoric, was it used at Carolina Gay Association meetings? Was that some connections that were made then between the civil rights movement and gay rights, or is that kind of only in retrospect that people started making those connections between civil rights and...
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, I don't think we tried to piggyback. I mean, we knew then that probably among blacks in the black community that gay rights was not popular. We had members, though, in the organization who were black, but again, they were not visible when it came time. I know, to take this picture. There might be one black person here, but the connections. I know we were drawing, though. Everybody was drawing on civil rights, the lessons learned in terms of organizing. And visibility, and what was, you know, because it was so much a part of us. Get publicity, work at the local level, you know, first. But in terms of building coalitions, I don't know that we were that far along in the late 70s.
And were there coalitions with any other student groups, do you know, like Students for Democratic Society or anything like that, or was the CGA pretty much an island unto itself when it came to student organizations?
There at UNC?
Yes.
I think it was more of an island. But I'm not the best person to ask that. And Dan Leonard would remember if there were coalitions, maybe with Young Democrats or others.
Yeah, Corinne talked to him yesterday, so I'll have to ask her.
Okay, yeah.
But it did seem like there was a lot of communication with, like, UNCG and ECU and the other, or at least you would publish.
We published in their notices.
Yeah.
I think there was among the other fledgling gay groups.
And do you remember if any, you mentioned that a professor specifically mentioned, like, exploring sexuality. Mm-hmm. Do you remember if there were any openly gay professors at the time that you were there, or if there are any professors who were particularly involved with the CGA in any capacity?
I don't recall that much. I think there were, though. I think there may have been a classics professor.
Cecil Wooten?
Right. But I'm hearing, you know, I'm actually getting that after the fact. I'm not really remembering it firsthand so much. But I think there were others, and I think partly it's just that from this vantage point in time, I'm fuzzy on those connections, because I know I felt there was some support, and I think the grad students who were the leaders in the organization definitely had some support.
And were the grad students and the undergraduate students in the CGA pretty well integrated, or within the CGA, was there like the grad students who were kind of the leaders and like the older people, and then the undergraduates kind of?
That's why I was more the worker bee on the newsletter. But yeah, I think the grad students were the leaders, and they felt some safety at being in academia, more entrenched in the university. Or they felt, because of what they were going into, a number were going into counseling with a specialty in human sexuality, and there was, that was when, I don't know, there was academic freedom was very much, that was just the default position. I think they felt safety from just being academically oriented. In a way that I never quite felt as much, because I wasn't on that track at all. I just saw myself working.
Yeah, and being a journalist with any part of your identity, with political identity, with just any part, you always have to be careful about which cards I feel like you should or play.
Yeah, and so I felt like I was doing this as a student. And I had the right to be involved, just like I'd be involved in a political party, and had been. I'd done some politicking in high school, and worked for different candidates and things. Worked for Shirley Chisholm, so I saw it more as, being in a club, being involved, but something that I would leave behind. And I didn't stay really, I never did a lot politically after I became a journalist, because that's just the way, that's just the culture that of a journalism school, and the way my mindset was that I never again really got involved in any sort of way, political party or anything. Only recently, since I'm not working really for a news organization, that I felt like I had a little more freedom, or I've given myself permission to do a little more. That dies hard, because I always sort of try to be, take as much as possible sort of the bystander journalist kind of approach. And I want to know both sides of every issue. I want to hear, even if I have my political persuasion, it's like I went and talked to the Republicans who were set up at the Arts Festival here in Durham last weekend, trying to get some other get their points of view on some issues I was interested in. So I think that's just I think that's a good outlook, actually, for anybody to have. Try to gather lots of information.
Definitely. Well, those are all the questions I have. Is there anything else about your time at Carolina or Lambda that that you'd like to... It looks like you have so many great documents. I might have to snap a few pictures, okay, if that's okay.
Great. Let me just see if I... as I look through notes, if there was anything else that... I know that... I think we were very protective of our mailing list, and we sent that out. We didn't share it with folks, and distribution. We were sending it out to people in the community, maybe who weren't open or whatever. It was in a plain envelope. So I remember that aspect of it. I will mention. Only have good things to, good feelings about the journalism school. While I wasn't, it was just me. I think I probably could have come out and been, I would have been supported by most of the people that, most of my instructors. I just wasn't sure enough. But really, this would not have been possible without the resources of the journalism school, which I took advantage of. And then you mentioned the rap group. The rap group was really, was really great. The awareness, what did they call it? I wrote down gay awareness rap group. I don't know if that, I was thinking consciousness raising, which is what you mentioned. One thing I did, I was open at least to some extent on campus, because a couple of times I was asked to be part of a panel where they just wanted gay people up on the stage to talk about human sexuality. And it was either at the med school or the School of Social Work.
And I know that they had a class on human sexuality for undergraduates. I think it might have been in 1977, so while you were there, I think the School of Public Health maybe it had
might,
it.
Yeah, might have been. And that was... felt very odd, really, to do.
And what kind of questions were people asking at those panels?
I think just about how hard it was to be gay. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was very open about the struggle and having had a nervous breakdown and very much tied directly to having told my parents. When you're coming into college and instead of hitting the ground running and learning and getting into your classes, you're preoccupied with coming out to your parents and for the first time able to, had been in a convent or something, in a monastery. I mean, I did not leave home to even go over. We live near East Carolina, but I did not go over. I did not have any contact as a gay person and, any intimate contact with anybody until I came to Chapel Hill. And that is very unlike young people, I'm sure, today. So you can just imagine that. I'm dealing with that. Sometimes I look back in amazement sometimes that I got back on track at all. But by the time I left, I was... except for still not having learned how to type, I was ready to join the world, and I felt pretty well prepared, and